Lovely. Thank you. Anyone who comes out on a night like this deserves at least a decent evening of poetry, if not a medal. So thank you. I assume that the point of this evening is we're quite close up with each other and we actually can talk about these things. I will give you a kind of starter pack of various angles on this. I would be very glad if anyone wants to pick up questions or just reflections of points that bounce off you, either as life or as writing. I'm betting that at least half the people in this room are writers yourselves. Yeah. Okay. I won't ask for more than a surreptitious nod, but I do see quite a lot of them. So that feeling of being on the same side of this and knowing that, you know, actually being interested in that process where these things happen, that self-quip that I started with earlier about it, if you haven't said it in 18 books. I mean, in fact, that feels nothing like what I feel I'm up to when I write. It, at no point does this start with me feeling that I have got my personal message inside that needs saying. You know, if I did and I knew that, I would probably write articles in the press. I wouldn't write poetry because, and I'm still fumbling for the feeling of why poetry is needed, but I'm sure it's about the experiment and about finding out what is there waiting to emerge from that thought and that language. I'm also sure that it feels like more and more being in conversations with all kinds of things, whether it's other people or other things or just with the words on the page. That also is a conversation that goes both ways. I said that I would judge whether it felt right to be standing up. I'm still judging. I was aware of about three people at the back who we wouldn't have been in touch with each other. I was slightly averse to standing up and looming over you. But if this is all right.
We can certainly see you better here, can't we?
Yeah. You tactfully don't mention whether that's an advantage or not. Thank you. Okay, so you've heard that one of these recent books was directly a kind of inter-art form conversation going back between words and visual images. Even in books which aren't explicitly doing that, there's often visual art or an artist there who are starting stimulus point, whatever. One of my favourite artists, in that sense of being someone whose work kind of gets up underneath your skin, and it goes on itching, usually with pleasure, or at least with curiosity. One of those people is Paul Klee. So, an example of having a kind of conversation with a person who died 70 years ago. But he's one of those people. One of the things that might be worth investing in an afterlife for would be to meet people like that. I'll say that this book is conscious of its age. You know, the fact that it wears this little tag of being my 18th and so in some sense a kind of coming of age. It's also a book that's very much of the age I am. I think the least we can do in honesty is to write from the place we are, which means being the place we are in the body we're in, being the age we are. So quite a lot of poems in this book are about being the age one is. I've suddenly become interested in those artists who have distinctive late styles. That's a phrase that gets used for musicians and artists and all kind of people. And it happened very obviously in the case of Clay. There's a very interesting book about late style by Edward Said, and he's especially interested in people who've reached a very high level of craft. And then, in the last phase of their life, it was almost as though they said, I haven't got time to be that careful anymore. There's something more urgent. And who moved on to doing things, but it looked, in a way, quite scrappy, quite scratchy, almost as though they had lost all of that craft. But his argument was, it's not that. There's this distinctive thing, a kind of creative impatience of old age that he distinguishes as late style. It was very much, there are very good reasons for that in Clay's life. Gradually, in the 1930s, the whole hospitable world had turned against him as the Nazis took over. He'd been working at the Bauhaus. Suddenly, he was one of these artists dismissed as decadent. And he ended his life in exile. He was also ill in a slow way, but he knew it would be the end of him. So he knew that time was running out in lots of ways. So in four short pieces, this is Paul Clay, the late style. Came to painting on burlap, not for lack of fine paper or canvas. See the effort of scraping the paint across that surface, almost pain. And the stuttering, crude and approximate edge. His own skin drying, scleroderma, paint on that. The opposite of watercolour, where juice and gravity take us with ideas of their own. But sackcloth, paint that dries before it's left the palette, that has to be dragged, already crusted. There could be despair in this, or freedom, knowing that already it's too late. That kettle drummer, he made almost nothing but his drum. Like the broadcasts hammering the airwaves nightly into the shape of a war, like waking in the darkness, your heart thumping but no other edge to your body, lost sensation of its borders, just this dull percussion surging in, out, sure as the tide, if the tide could be dry. If you can't help but hear the drumming, if there's nowhere, even with the Alps between you, at a far enough remove, then, as your canvases are hung, skewed, decadent, fenced round, degenerate with crude graffiti, as your own skin tightens on the bone cage, be the bold, bald mark on what you can lay hands on. Be the drum skin beating till it rips. Still beating. Don't say beaten, even then. I'm not saying that I'm standing in anything like the same place as that. They go, you get tiny quivers you can extrapolate from a feeling that you're looking round at a world that has put itself grindingly into a kind of reverse gear. This book is called Love Songs of Carbon. I need to explain both parts of that. Carbon, because that is a very large part of what we are, actually, that and water mixed in various complicated ways. A few other small elements added in, but actually water and carbon is most life on Earth. So that brings us down to brass tacks, really. And love songs, because frankly they very largely are. And it sounds embarrassing to say that not only did I write at least half the things in this book with my wife in mind, but actually gave some of them to her as birthday presents. People are very hard on occasional verse, aren't they? I think all verse has occasions. I mean, else, you know, where's it? How does it put its feet on the ground? But let me. This is one occasion of a few winters back. We were given the gift of Christmas Day on our own, because the whole family was converging on us, and it snowed, and there was black ice, and tragically nobody could make it. So we got like naughty children, and we sat at home and ate mince pies. It was lovely. We also went out for a walk by the sea on some flat water meadows near us. This is called A Walk Across a Field. You might recognise an old Russian proverb there, saying, life is not a walk across a field. A week of snow, slight melt, refreeze, and it comes to this. The ground withholds consent at every step. It has us grappling, gasping at each other like the fond emergencies of young love. Now my high-tech walking pole becomes a straw I clutch at, drowning nearly in the blank expanse of frozen water meadow, quivering with strain. This isn't a stroll, it's a horizontal mountain, sheer drops always at our feet, like any pavement for the very old. No time or surface is quite level. Once clear pools grow dim-eyed and tense, they too thicken and bulge with threatening opacities. Who knows how brittle? We make it back to the car. I count us in. Me, you, back from the ice age to real time, to the age we are for now. One day, if I'm the one left to remember longer, I'll remember this. Come on in.
Sorry, I think it's
no,
the seats at the Fomoros.
I'm glad you persevered. And your penalty for coming in late is you have to sit.
Thank you.
Such
a part
of
the
naughty
This is the naughty stuff.
Naughty seat.
Yeah. I wrote a whole book, in fact a whole book and a half, about the last years of my father. I won't read anything from it now, but that's an entire book, which was written for him and with him at the point of the very end of his life, when he was losing all of his spoken language with aphasia. So there was a man who had once spoken five languages well. And the oddness was, apart from the awfulness of feeling that veil of unlanguage coming down between us, in some ways we got closer to each other in those years without words than in all those years when we had, when we both thought we were quite good at them. Mm-hmm. So he had his book. That certainly was a kind of conversation with him at a point when we couldn't do it any other way. I mean, he could just about read many of the things in the book, but that was a bit beyond him. So in a way, it was an exchange with him taken on trust. He had approved of and recognised things that I had written from his life in the past. So at that point, we were both there, but it was very much trusting. It left me feeling that there was one thing unfinished, not unsaid with him, but in most of those last years, my aged mother had been there as well. And the fact that she was the person I had always been able to talk to earlier, and you know, she doesn't have her book from me, kind of maybe because we didn't need that, or maybe because it's waiting to catch up. But at least in this latest one, there is one piece that brings them both in, kind of both the conversation with me and the rest of the family and each other. They weren't always. Actually, they were good at being in touch with each other, but again, largely not in words. And some things did get lost down that gap. So this is not at the end, but beyond the end of their lives. And the landscape in the background is that of the western edge of Dartmoor. A little rush of place names at the end. This is a love song of Carl. For 6 years, on a high shelf in an upstairs bedroom, she was the only one who didn't change. Down here in the oxygen economy, we came and went, our carbon still mixed with water, breathing, moistening, drying. Yes, even our youngest, there, etching in breath on the glass, now a smiley or down in the mouth, now moon-faced, dripping. While he took time, the eldest, withering without her, needing ointments for his thin and flaking skin, those sores on his shins did his weeping, the chemical bonds coming loose, letting parts of him go. As patient as she'd learnt to be in life, she waited, dressed and contained, in leather-textured cardboard round a screw-top urn. 6 years till the day they could meet in all simplicity, at last entirely conversant with each other. Ash into ash lifts from my broadcast scatter, and into a wet wind for winnowing, chalkier flakes dropping free into wire-rooted ling, small gorse, bell heather, rabbit's guts, the finer grains fetched up, we flinch, then stay, yes, why not let them dust us? Lifting towards Sheepstor, North Hessery Tor, Great Mistor, and the deeper moor, beyond whatever skyline he or she had ever reached. The rain clouds come up over Cornwall, like the grey Atlantic. Generations, wave on wave on wave. I think I had the urge to mention the place that is, because it feels as if the place itself is part of the conversation going on between me and them there. It feels though it matters to acknowledge that occasions like that happen in an actual place, just like I was talking about acknowledging that you're writing in the body you've got of the age you've got now. The book I'm holding in my hands now is entirely the book of a place. I've lived and worked in Wales, indeed South Wales, for the last 12 years. And for the first few years, I was living at a cottage halfway up the valley of the River Taff. This is right in the heart of the old mining valleys. Now, these valleys are now very green. If it had been there 50 years back, they were anything but. Mm. They were black. You know, and the water that flowed past was black. So that kind of beauty there that is also the beauty of the emptiness that the industry, that first iron, then coal, that brought hundreds of thousands of people into those valleys that they would, where they wouldn't otherwise have been, have now left them there and has gone. So it's a kind of ambiguous beauty which you love and regret. And if no one wants that danger and dirt of mining back. Here, a couple of weeks after the 50th anniversary of Aberfan. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we lived in the next village downstream by Aberfan. So there is a curious vacuum. In a sense, you can see it in the excessive greenness and the excessive smoothness of hillsides that have been smoothed over in the place where the slag heaps would have been. But also, actually, in the problem of young men being men. You know, if you want to study a kind of crisis of masculinity, to look in a place where an intensely male industry has been and has gone, and find young men there who haven't even seen their fathers working. Mm. The people who go on and work and do everything are those gallant valleys women who are brilliant and robust and do everything. And the young men, you know, do drink drugs, bit of light arson. They burn hillsides all the time, and quite often cars too. So in the middle of a book which is in some ways kind of glorying in the strange mixed landscape of that valley, this comes directly from a very revealing conversation with my next-door neighbour in the valleys, who is the most gentle, sweet man I've ever met. But he knew how to torch a car. He taught me. I didn't do it. But this is called Torched. And here, by the old stone-packed bridge, by the hush of quick waters at the track's end, lest we rhapsodise, is a torched fiesta, blister crusts and sooty freckles in the scorched paint that's no colour, sea changed to coral by fire. Upholstery, refined black talc in a circuit diagram of fine springs, trims and wires. Rear windscreen popped out whole by the writhe of buckling steel and fists of heat pressure inside. Sunk on its axles, in the mucking out of its own innards, almost comfy in its well-fouled nest. Don't ask why, but how? Just one match in the tank? Are you nuts? My gentle neighbour looks at me concerned, as if I'd had the misspent childhood. You siphon that gallon, douse a quick libation, then dribble a fuse. Oh, and a twist of rag to give the flame a leg up, like a courtesy. Then run like hell. We share a grin. At least we try. This revenant of burning rubber, raised, not laid by the oncoming rain, stays on as we go. Two or three a month, it's regular. Failed phoenix. But each time it beats those tattered wings of flame, you'd swear one day it'll make it to the sky. I was thinking I'd just read a couple. Well, I just kind of cast those as bread on the waters, really. And it might be that when we talk, it'll bring up something else that it immediately feels useful to have read that as well. One of the other things I do is I write poetry for young people. Having said which, I am very certain I never want to write anything for young readers that I wouldn't want adults to read as well. I've got a strong feeling that if I'm writing anything that adults would feel patronised by, well, so should the kids, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, their experience is as big and as rich as ours. So there's a kind of conversation going on with that world, and it does, and quite a lot of the things that I write for that age come out of doing workshops in schools. One of the findings of which is that if you ask young people from a standing start what kind of poetry they like reading, they'll come up with some really very conservative, very safe answers, really only things which have a nice joke punchline at the end, and preferably mention Knickers or Snot. But once you're writing with them, once they're thinking not like consumers but like writers, then their tastes blossom. Extraordinary, you know, there are no boundaries, you know, they want to be part of all the richness that is. So I've got great hope with that. And it also seems a good moral for, you know, the way people look at life at all. You know, what you want when you think as a consumer is different from what you write when you think as a participant. Discuss. I've been doing workshops with schools and with specialists in deep sea worms at the National Museum in Cardiff. If you think that sounds dull, find out about polychaete worms. They are a glorious world of their own. But the thing that led me there is a lot of the things in my next book for young readers and older ones will be about creatures and people who live at the extremes. I got very interested in extremophiles, those life forms that live in implausible places. Most of us know now that at the bottom of our deepest oceans, in the place where the tectonic plates are slowly ripping apart, there are volcanic vents. It's a most incredibly hostile place you can think of, you know, an atmosphere of sort of boiling sulfuric acid and no light and the kind of pressure that would act like a car crusher. This is called the abyss. They say there are delicate shrimps of no colour, like ghosts of themselves, in ocean trenches past the reach of light, as remote as deep space. They say there is smoke that rises black in the blackness from rips in the earth's core, through black water hot as fire, laced with acid and sulphur, like a hell dissolving upwards, water groaning with the weight of ocean 3 miles high. And the shrimp, with its feather-like gills, its pernickety feelers, with its surgeon's kit of probes and pincers, all its many pinpoint feet, goes tiptoe, sifting, picking. It seems to be dancing its way round the slopes of the crumbling and shuddering drowned volcanoes, a thing in a dream. You can't even think what it's thinking or knowing or how, except it comes to you. Yes, me here, and whatever. I can live through this. One last thing, perhaps. I was invited by an artist to take part in a project that he'd been involved in. His particular interest is the oceans, and particularly the plastic in the oceans. You know, the thing that our age will be known by, the thing that will make us the plastic age, like the Stone Age with the Stone Age and the Bronze Age with the Bronze Age. Because it's... Well, yeah. The starting point that he and a few musicians had agreed on was John Masefield's poem, Sea Fever. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost all of us at school learned, I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely, etc. And he wanted someone of our age to write their version or write in response to that very, very well-known Masefield. I did check that he didn't want simply satire. He didn't want just a kind of parody of it, because I certainly didn't feel like doing that. And he said, no, you know, you just, it's just come at the thoughts in the poem and find out where it leads. So, bear with me, this is in four parts, but they aren't long parts. And Masefield's Sea Fever came out as Three Fevers and a Fret. Sea sleepless. How can sea sleep? Fever fretted in its oily night sweat. Come, you must come down to me. Sea tossed and tide wracked. Listen, lay your head down close enough to hear. My tiffs of wind, my short-breathed shingle hiss. All night, the dark behind my eye blooms dimly. Spray mist falls back, leaving... Whose is this tangle of filaments, frayed and knotting, nerve ends in the weed? Whose is this inconsolable dull cry? 5 a.m. and they're yakking and yowling, the sea's appetite unhinged. Just yesterday, one rapped on my window with that crazed eye, that skewed side stare straight at me. Big, stroppy black back with his slash and jab at anything. His neighbour's chicks are stinking bin bag. Who cares? Some alarm. It's fight and flight now. Smash and grab at the sky. The sea's hunger astray for a raid on the landfill at the dump truck's heels. Hunger that grows with feeding. Never filled, but wakes us with its clangor at the tideline of our sleep. And whether it's the seas or ours, this hunger, who's to say? And in the voice of the sea. Strange freight you give me, neither dead nor living. Nothing in its molecules will melt to my embrace. Is this what you meant with your myths of ever after? Never rotting, never rusting. Even iron comes to trust me in the end. Release me, it says. Shell, bone, even glass returns to sand. So we sift down. Nothing should float for long. Things need to rest. But this, in gullet, gizzard or the gut of me, I who know everything by touch, can't reach it alone in its terrible dream. To be blown and driven, circle in an eddy, last beyond endurance, never find a home. I am sick, C says. You must listen. Sick of many things, including your pathetic fallacies. That song you thought you heard wasn't mine. At last night's bin in the deserted market. Listen, the snatch mobs of dawn are at the innards, spilled as if your own, the day's trick. And the tall ships stitching trade routes round the earth to bag, to cash and carry. Listen. Catch the glitter swish of shoals, switching grey silver grey to off. The shiver to stillness of the coral bleaching. With the slow spreading of the spill to pools of silence. The 100-mile spool of wave song, whale song snapped. I have no words for you.
That was a wonderfully prowling reading, wasn't it? Don't give someone a lectern and they occupy the space. Would anyone like to? Is there anybody liking to ask something, or shall I begin? Is there a feeling? Have you got anything in your mind? I mean, I was going to start with simply an... which I think even having heard your reading, I'm going to still start with, which is... and maybe it is a kind of slightly a writer's question, but how do you write so much? and I am interested in that, in the process. How's it all, what's your process? How do you work? And how are you so free in some ways to, how does it work?
A great advantage is living a working lifestyle in which it feels as though you haven't got time to write anything at all. So you never have the intimidating experience of sitting down with all day to work on something with a piece of white paper making you go snowblind as you stare at it. But things that get written are the things that niggle and nag. And I start writing things down in notebooks on a train or on the bus or... that moment at 4 o'clock in the morning when you wake up and it says, go away. And you realise that all you can do is reach out to your bedside pad. You don't put the light on out of courtesy to the person in the other half of the bed, and you just write down a few key words which either will or won't bring it back in the morning. I think the issue of speed is interesting. I find working with writing students, one thing that sometimes cures people of self-diagnosed writer's block is being tossed anything very fast, a catch, just as if we were practicing kind of advanced ball skills, and I had a ball in my hand and I went to catch. You would. Before you had thought how you would do it.
Yeah.
And I think something like that happens. There's a kind of liberation and not having time to worry.
Mm.
I will say one other thing, which was that it was one quite formative moment, perhaps 20-odd years ago. And I was in St. Ives and watching a Japanese potter at work. I was admiring these very simple pots they've made with one spiral mark on them. And I thought, that is so graceful, that is so right. And I watched him doing it, and he was doing it by waiting and then making a single mark when the thing was still turning on the wheel. And I suddenly felt that something had given me a little Zen slap in the head. And they said, you know what you would have done? You would have done 30 drafts of that, Philip. You would have stopped the wheel and corrected a bit and tip-exed out a bit, and then you could have put it up to it, and it would have looked rubbish. But, there was a kind of appetite and envy for the grace of that one breath.
Mm.
You know,
mm.
I wouldn't claim I got there.
Yeah.
But it's been a kind of benchmark.
Mm.
So I think that's something about it.
Yeah. At what point in your writing did that happen? Because that's.
I think for my first few books, people would have described me ambiguously with words like fastidious.
Mm-hmm.
I was seen as being a very careful craftsperson.
Do you think that was an important stage to go through, though?
Yes.
In order to move on? Because
I think you need to get it in order to let it go.
Yeah.
I do, you know. I think it really matters, actually, being able to do formal things of rhythm and rhyme in order to be able to write good free verse. In fact, if you look at my things on the page, there's quite a lot of pattern in it.
Yeah.
But not quite in the same sense. So, yeah, that happened some way in. When I already had a few books out.
So those of us who are still stuck in the business with the Tippex,
yes,
we're not necessarily wasting our time.
No, I think you've got. Well,
get through that.
If we're talking about this being anything like Zen, we've all had the business of that Zen art of archery, where you've got to stand there. And learn to pick up the bow for 7 years before you're allowed to pick up the arrow in the other hand. Let alone fire the damn thing. So I do think just getting craft inside you, so that you can wear it more lightly. You know, it will probably tell you when you can do that. Trust it. So.
Did you go through an early stage where you not exactly copied other poets who inspired you, but mimicked them? Or did you always feel as though you were writing this yourself?
Yeah. I've never been sure about this writing as myself thing. I know the orthodox thing we should all want is to find our voice. I'd rather think about finding voices, or I'd rather think about letting voices find us. I think it's a terrifying moment in a writer's life when people start, even quite admiringly, tell you what you do. No! I don't want to know. Or, you know, the next thing you do is you start paddling steadily away from the thing you now know that you can do. And there's a special danger. If you know you can do it and people like it, because if you're anything like me, who, you know, there's part of me is this pathetic little dog which will dance on its hind legs if it gets patted on the head, and that's no good for the poetry. So so I think it's really important to be apprenticed to a lot of other voices.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we do learn to be ourselves, it's through trying on lots of other people's clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And you wear them as long as you need to, and then you discard them. And you keep a few bits and you end up with kind of ensemble of things you've picked up all over the place that at some point just becomes you.
Mm-hmm. Were there some key influences in your...
Most of the ones I could name, I name with a kind of embarrassment. You know, at the age of 14, I started writing poems which I assigned P.J. Gross, as in T.S. Eliot. You know, T.S. Eliot and D.H. Lawrence and people like that did that with their initials. So, so Eliot, I was one of those people who started with Eliot early and who kind of fell in love with the wasteland.
Mm.
At an age when I didn't understand a blind word of it. And that was all right. You know, it made my hair stand on end. That was the real test of thinking, you can do that. You can do that. You know, later on I studied it and read books and I thought, oh, so that's what it means. Yes, okay. But it added a bit, but not very much, to that first astonishment, the kind of enablement. I could name various people turned up at the right moment, and I think that just means it's important to be around lots of bookshelves with lots of poetry books on them. So you can have that experience of, you know, you don't know that you're looking for it, but one day something seems to fall off and land open in your hand. You think, what's that doing there? And it turns out to be exactly what you need.
Mm-hmm.
But it does mean being around lots of the stuff, I think. Sorry, there was a question there.
Well, there were two things that resonated with me from what you've just been talking about. And the first one is sometimes working quickly, because for a little while in the early 2000s, I worked with brain injured adults. We had 2 hours in the afternoon to do creative writing, and what it turned out to be was poetry.
Yes.
And they had 2 hours, so we had to introduce it, and we have to do thought showers, because it wasn't PC to say brainstorming, which they thought was hilarious. Lots of words on a flip chart, old-fashioned flip charts.
Yeah.
And so it was interesting how, because with a lot of brain injury, word finding, aphasia, and certain difficulties with, one student had a difficulty with the letter P, which we all thought was hilarious, so we teased her about it a lot. So after about 20 minutes, they'd have so long to sit down and write something. So they'd been introduced to the subject. And the other thing you said about other writers, I remember one of the introductory lines was, rain doesn't always. And now out of these sort of 10 students, I would be going around sort of just supporting them a little bit, and it was firing me off as well. And at the end, the tutor would say, well, you've got to write something as well. But really, the crux of it is we found time to have tea and a break and a chat, and at the end of it, everybody read something that they'd written. Yes. And it was the most incredible experience. In 2 hours, there's something they've written, and that leads me on to seeing it as a therapeutic thing. You know, poetry is therapy.
Yes.
And have you any experience using it in that way in your teaching?
Mm, the first thought is, in the poetry world, you will find a lot of people who scoff at the idea of poetry as therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I am not one of those people.
So
absolutely not. I think, kind of, what's the point of doing it if it doesn't do some human good?
Mm.
And it's not about what those people who scoff think it would be about, which is about soothing and salving. One of the things that helps us, and I guess possibly even cures us most, is the right kind of clarity.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you this form in which you can hold an experience.
Mm.
And, you know, just as we've talked about whether what you write is your experience or your meaning or what you think or whether it becomes something else, it's the fact that it does become something else, mm-hmm. which both is you and isn't you, that you can stand back and look at that experience. Once it's in words, it's got this life of its own. And actually, to write it well is like caring for it,
mm-hmm.
in the sense of helping it be itself, you know, not helping it be some other perfect thing, mm-hmm. but helping it be the very best version of itself that it can be. So,
thank you. That just sort of came out of
what I was saying,
because by the end of it, I did see the students change.
Yes.
And I did see them get things out that they hadn't been able to necessarily express.
Mm. Yes.
Because a brain injury is a very complex thing,
yeah.
It's incredibly personal.
Yes.
But the big thing is, for most of the students I work with,
mm.
they feel life is over there,
yes.
here, and who they were.
Yes.
Is no longer there, but there are people out there in their lives that still see them as the person they were, and they can't be that person.
Mm.
So in that environment,
yes.
for 2 hours,
yes.
they were purely themselves,
yes.
and trying to find a way to express themselves.
Mm.
So,
that's
yeah.
very true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm.
Did any of them have the experience of being able to show what they'd written to the other people in their lives?
Yes.
That they would
yes.
recognise.
I think that's important as therapy.
I went to a 60th birthday party, and the children of one of the students had picked out some of the poems she'd written. You know,
yes.
It's more than 10 years ago now.
Yes.
And read them at the surprise party. Mm. So that was quite something. And I brought some of them with the tutor. We came to the poetry festival, we had an open mic.
Yeah.
And several of them stood up and read.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there is something about finding a voice.
Mm, absolutely.
Isn't it? You know, it's such a. It is a part of us that is so deep inside us. And I don't say that blindly. I know that not everyone has that spoken voice. You know, what made me a writer was growing up. As a child and young man with an extremely bad stammer, and you know,
and having the courage
and
to put it out there and find a safe environment for
you've
got to trust.
Interestingly, one of the first things that I found a voice with was poetry.
I was thinking about what you were saying. It's very interesting thinking about that sort of work of poetry with someone with damage to the brain.
Mm.
Because it occurs to me that that moment when something's coming and you're writing and you're not thinking and you don't know where you're going, that's when you're making connections that you can't find if you look for them in a very conscious way.
They have to come
and
really quickly.
Yeah.
And that's what's...
Yeah.
Perhaps that's why perhaps poets are envious of that. You know, that sort of sense of it being a therapy. That's the enjoyable bit, the really enjoyable bit. It's when you're then trying to make it into something that will last that I think is, you know, a certain...
Oh.
And you try to work at it afterwards, then it becomes...
Is that overthinking?
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't think we should worry about lasting very much. No. I mean,
but we do, though, don't we?
Yeah.
Well, it's a worry about having a sort of universal thing where anyone who reads it will be able to relate to it.
I think what I really mean is that you get something that comes very suddenly, and then you're trying to get the rest of it. It's that bit when you feel like you've only got a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you've made a connection, and you want to go with it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And you're hanging on.
I think, what I think about that extra bit of work is, in a sense, helping the thing leave home and
mm-hmm.
become not simply you,
mm-hmm.
and not depending on you standing there and saying, you know, this really happened.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the real acid test of any bit of writing is that if you read out one of those things that palpably move the audience, and you see a little kind of wiping of the corners of people's eyes and think, good, good, good. But, you know, that if you then said, well, actually, I'll be honest, my dog didn't die, and I've never had a dog, and I don't really like dogs. If the fact that people have been moved by the poem winks out of existence and is replaced by anger and scorn,
yes.
Then it probably was not the poem that was moving them. Whereas if they say, well, okay, I mean, you can be who you like, Philip, but I'm still moved by that poem. Then it's left home and it can make it its own way in the world.
Mm.
And that's what I want, you know. I would like to be a writer of poems like a good parent is a parent. You don't want to keep the brats at home forever. You don't want to be always tidying them up and doing their laces. Them, you want them to not need you anymore. And if one of them occasionally sends a postcard home, well, that's nice.
I was going to ask a bit about this. One of the things I've noticed when I was reading Love Songs of Carbon was that you have lots of sort of brackets or bits in it that are sort of, and I wondered if that's something which relates a little bit to what we've been talking about, to do with a kind of honesty that you're looking for, where you're resisting the poem feels like it could just take me and sweep me up in a wonderful way, and you sort of...
Yes.
Oh, and then I think, oh, maybe it's a conversation you're having with yourself, and I'm witnessing that. And actually, it doesn't... For me, it didn't change how I was feeling about the poems in some senses.
Mm.
But it was something I was curious about. I'd like to know a bit about that. Going on there.
I'm glad to be in the presence of someone who finds my brackets interesting rather than simply irritating.
Oh, yeah. So I like the brackets, but I was curious what they were. For me, there was a sense of a kind of integrity where you're sort of determined not to allow a kind of lyricism or something to sweep us off our feet. I don't know.
It's not quite as much of an intention as that, though it might have that. It's actually the fact that kind of side thoughts spark, and need to be not lost, because they actually were part of that movement of a thought, and I don't want to just plough on past them. You know, I think most of us at any age, but probably more so as we get older, know when you're in the middle of saying something and a really important and interesting side thought associates with that and hangs in the air next to you. You thought, oh good, that's really nice, I'll come back later. And you turn around and it's gone. So to some extent I'm registering that. In a sense, it's not wanting to move only in one dimension, but being able to write in two or three more at the same time.
And sort of layering the strata that you can see, it's almost...
Which is greedy. I mean, it's like building in hyperlinks. I'm sure people will do that as well. But I also... There's also a thing you can do, if it works, which is to preserve the kind of forward momentum of a sentence, because I think the sweep of a sentence is a powerful thing, that a whole gesture, and yet interrupt it so it kind of hangs in the air, and you can still feel in the air what the graph of it would be, but you can kind of stop time at that moment and examine one word, examine one bit in it, but hopefully without that feeling of the arc of it in the air being lost. Mm-hmm. You know, partly that's what I think I do with probably odd line endings as well. You know, you kind of cast things out over the void and make them pause.
You sort of cut words up.
Yeah.
So you take a word and sort of halve it or splice it. And
yes, you can do that as well. Yeah, yeah.
which is and there's a fabulous poem in this Love Songs, which is mold music, which seems to do that a lot, to the point where it feels like, for me, I was sort of, it was a sense of the decay of the words that they're sort of, but also it obviously brings out new meanings to words too, which is lovely. But
and it must be said that that's actually a kind of celebration of mould.
It is.
Yeah.
It's, if you talk about looking for poetry in things you wouldn't expect, then that's a super one for that. It's got a super bus shelter. But beautiful.
Yes. Dribblings and breathings of mould across your head, yes. And stuff that kind of blooms out of the walls at you.
Yeah.
And life on Earth would be sunk without it. It was one of the great early inventions of evolution. You know, when the early giant forests took off first, I mean, life had just happened on this thing, you know. I can make things grow really big. I can have 100-foot trees up, and then, you know, what am I going to do with them now? And they have to fall down. You know, what happens to them? Something's got to break them down. And, you know, that's essential.
You know, so in the collection has all this. It is about a body getting older, and but that's what you seem to have a kind of. Almost not a. I felt almost like there was a real. It was. It's the most punchy bit poem, seemed to me, are the ones about the body. They're very direct. With love, you often are finding wonderful slanty angles to me. The lovely poem about a couple who wake in different positions, and I love that poem. But with the body, it's suits. Yeah.
I mean, it's also worth mentioning that it's about both. My wife and I being the age we are, you know. Mm-hmm. Her being actually 5 years older than I am, so getting there first. Yeah. To all of these things, very much it's about love at the ages we are. It's not a bodiless love.
No, exactly. But it's also about the body in the sense of looking for mystery, the body finding the way into other things. There's a lot of mystery about, and the questions, you leave a lot of questions and... Those three dots appear a lot.
That's the other thing. Those and the brackets. I was doing a writing workshop a couple of weekends back at Gladstone's library, and we got a whole day's work out of what seemed like a playful question that we did just as a kind of intro round the group first, which was, if you were one item of punctuation, what punctuation would you be? And it turned out to be hugely revealing of everybody. And partly people looked at the things they write, and you know, most people know that they are recognisable by having an awful lot of commas or dashes or...
none at all.
Oh, none at all, yes. Yeah, and you know, everyone knows I'm kind of brackets and ellipses. Yes. I do have a sequence in that book called Several Species of Ellipses.
Well, we probably ought to end our conversation element if anyone has any final questions, or should we ask Philip to read a final poem or two before we go? If you'd like.
Okay.
Do you want to finish? It's nice to finish on.
Yes.
We're a little over time, but we've still got time for our open mic, so I think we're doing okay, are we?
Yeah.
Are everyone happy?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay.
Okay. I would read that mold music one, but it's too long. It's a sequence,
yes,
isn't it? It's fun.
Super poems.
What's that? Can I read something entirely other? I haven't said much about the other conversation in the book, which is between poetry and science, which I think is the source of a great deal of genuine wonder in our world. You know, it's not just mechanics, it is real wonder and awe, and a thing that can make us feel really humble. When I was talking about the arc of a sentence, which you can kind of hold in midair, I realised the image that I had in my mind is, you know, when you watch squirrels running, they describe their own arc in the air, and sometimes one can stop and it stays in its arc in the air. So this is about squirrels and quantum physics and love. I actually wrote this as a wedding song for two friends, both of whom really are scientists. This is called Epithalamium with Squirrels. Saw this today and thought of you too. There, not there, the quantum flicker of a squirrel, this side, that side of its tree trunk, right side up or down, an astonishment particle, a pop-eyed quivering on claw tips, gone. And I had to look sharp to be sure if this was one, like a pun on itself performed in mime, or, yes, it was two, released in skitter spirals, up, down, helix, counter helix, the play of material things in their nearliness, freak mutations of the moment, weightless prestidigitations, always meeting ourselves, coming back round the corner like the skyline of a wild surmise. And whether these new sudden selves we are together are the nouns, or whether now we know that particles are spin, vibration and momentum, it's the verb of us that is the one true thing, is immaterial beside this moment, everlasting under everlasting, that feels like return to lightness, against all the world's gravity, it slips between words, as in light, enlightenment, delight. Thank you.
I'd like to thank you very much, Philip, for that. It's lovely. And thank you, everyone, for the lovely questions. I felt there was a really lovely conversation that happened.
Absolutely.
A real
yeah.
treat. And thank you for inviting that so warmly and openly. So
good.
We can have a rest, have a little drink, and then we'll come back for our open mic.